Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, I'm Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing the campaign for an African permanent seat at the United Nations Security Council. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Adeoye Akinola. Dr. Akinola is the head of units and head of research and teaching at the Institute for Pan-African Thought and Conversation in South Africa. Dr. Kell, I'm very, very pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to an exciting conversation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Michael, and thanks for having me on your very stimulating conversation programs, and I'll be looking forward to the conversation.
Okay, brilliant. But before we get into the question, I want to just tell our audience to stay tuned to the end and subscribe and like and share this video at the end of the day. Yes, let me begin. So we've recently seen, or Africa has long campaigned for an inclusive United Nations Security Council, and they've long campaigned for having representation in that framework. But we've seen recent campaign for and which have received fresh boost from the United Nations Security General Antonio Guterres and other African, like Sierra Leone president. What is your assessment of this campaign overall?
Maybe I should first state that I think it's something that is long overdue, is belated, and sometimes we speak about it without actually committing ourselves to the task of assisting even the P5, the permanent member of the Security Council, to make their work easier. And I think the call couldn't have come at any better time. We can see from the north to the south, from the east even to the west, that the world needs leadership. There are conflicts across board, not only in Africa, even in Europe, and not only in Europe, and that's why I'm saying in other places in the world. And we can also think about the escalation of conflict even between Israel and Palestine, the unresolved conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And we can see in Africa also conflict relapse all over the place. So the time has actually come. It's not just about reforming, it's just to rethink the global architecture of peace and security. Definitely something is not working well. And that's why it is imperative that people speak about reforming the UN Security Council, because that's the ultimate organ of the UN General Assembly or United Nations generally that has enforcing capacity. And in a way, they are like the global police. So it seems as if there's failure from the part of the UN Security Council to police the world. So we begin to now question the composition, the structure, the character, the nature of the UN Security Council. And I'm particularly happy that even the UN Secretary General will lend his voice openly without missing his word to say we cannot, after about 76 years, that we have to reform. And we can also maybe later in the show question that maybe we need more than reform, but at the minimum, something must change for us to enjoy peace, prosperity, and development in the world.
Joko, I like what you said about the word needs leadership. So we've seen in the last, is it 70 years now, but since the end of the Second World War, and we've seen the United Nations have been, you know, that kind of like overarching body that you know, supervises conflicts or mediates or, you know, conflicts around the world. But in recent times, we've seen that the UN itself as a structure is needing reform or needing rethink. So what we've been seeing is reconfigurations at different levels of, so whereas we had at the end of the Cold War, we had where America emerged as the hegemon. But right now, we don't even have we have more like multiple hegemons. We have different configurations, the BRICS, you have the expansion of whether the G7. So we're seeing all of this. So I agree with you that all of this speaks to the need for leadership. And there's been like poor leadership. And I'm happy you mentioned this is not just in Africa, as usually people will say, it's everywhere. In America, we've seen the debates, you know, there's this lack of quality leadership. In all of this, Africa is becoming increasingly important. And a jostling among not just the superpowers, the usual suspect. We see even the mid powers in Turkey jostling for, you know, that in Africa. So what is the scale of Africa's significance in all of this? And what are the factors that are going to affect this?
Thank you so much. I think we have to start from the global south and dovetail into Africa. If you look at the geopolitics in the last maybe like 7 years, 5 years, and particularly after COVID or even during COVID, we are beginning to see a reconfiguration of global polarity. Like you said, power has shifted from being one unilateral actor to this multiplicity of relative big powers and medium powers, trying to act and get their voice also heard in the international scene as individual countries. But when it comes to the global institutions of governance, we have not only the UN, we can look at even G20, for instance. And it's not a coincidence that the presidency of G20 moved from Indonesia 2022 to India, you know, from India to Brazil, from Brazil now, South Africa will be the president next year. And if you look at them, the past three president, Indonesia, India, Brazil, and even South Africa. Those are countries in the global south. So I don't think it's a coincidence. That shows the relevance of the global south in the global politics, which we haven't seen or we didn't see during the Cold War, before the Cold War, and even shortly after the Cold War. Now, if you want to come to Africa, of course, now people say Black Lives Matter. No, African lives matter. That's what is in vogue now. And it's not even by accident that the African Union was admitted as a permanent member of the G20. It wasn't an accident. They had no choice but to admit the African Union. Look at it this way. The African Free Trade Architecture Initiative will be the biggest block and trade block in the entire world. Africa in the next 2 years will be talking about 1.5 billion population. And you also know it's not just about the population, but you look at the demographics, the categorization of the population, where we have almost 60% of the population, they are youth, they are these energized people. And you can compare that to Europe, where majority of the population are aged people, you know, collecting retirement fund. Now, let's come to mineral resources. Just Congo DRC enough. You know, it's enough for the entire world to want to scramble to get the soul of Congo DRC. So you look across Africa, and to me, Africa is the future. Either the world likes it or not, people can debate it, but for big power, they understand that Africa is the future. That's why you see countries like Saudi Arabia, country like Turkey, country like Qatar, having this, you know, very strange, you know, interest in Africa. So the time has come, and I hope African political elite will be able to take advantage of this blank check that has been opened before them. But if they are not careful, they will still continue to rely late, as if, you know, the era of dependency of colonialism. So that's why I say that this is the time for Africa to actually push for reform, at the minimum, reform across board, not only UN Security Council, the UN General Assembly itself, then IMF, World Bank. So, well, this is the right time to make those push. Yes.
Very, very interesting. It's you know, people call it like the third scramble for Africa. Now, you mentioned that was trouble. I will talk about DRC. DRC is very blessed. Mineral, all kind of land, forest, and then those countries as well, countries that are beleaguered with conflict. But you've said something very, very interesting in how this thing shapeshifts. Whereas in the first scramble, or coming up to the second, you know, colonial state, it was an unequal imbalance relationship where Africa was just more extractive, you know, extracting resources from Africa. But now there is an opportunity for Africa to be able to play a big role in determining how that relationship is. How do you think Africa is doing currently? Because you're talking in terms of hoping like Africa is able to do, but if you look at currently, how is Africa doing?
Well, somebody called it a pessimistic hope, not an optimistic hope. we can only hope because we are also African. And I think I want to also boldly say, if Africa gets it right, they may play a very prominent role even in global governance, in providing global leadership. But to be frank, as it is, African leaders have woefully performed. It's as if they have not really realized it. Maybe the nature of the international system, the shifting of polarity, and, you know, the advantage they can explore within the global system. I know that there is still a asymmetry relation whereby Africa has to depend, but it doesn't matter if you are dependent or not. But the main question is that the world needs Africa, not because they loved Africa, but because that has come to it has become a reality because of their mineral resources, because of their human capacity, because of also we talk of demographics of population where you have young people with diverse, you know, skills, you know, being, you know, raised even from Africa. But imagine our leaders. And, you know, I remember that President Ruto of Kenya said during his campaign that he was also alarmed that Africans would pack themselves in a bus and go to the US for one US African summit. And you cannot even imagine that there is, you know, a small country, Japan African summit. Japan will summon about 54 African leaders to travel to leave their country and come to Japan. And I went to Saudi recently, and they were talking to me about when African leaders came last year to Saudi African summit. This is embarrassing, actually. A president will summon about 54 presidents, and last week they were all in China and they were happy to pose in the camera. They have not understood what is going on in the world. Maybe, you know, sometimes you have clout, you might not know, and because many of them are also they're lacking in leadership and understanding, and maybe because most of them also they are more European, you know, more American than American, because all their investments are there abroad. Many of them even live in Europe. Some of them, I don't want to mention, I can mention about two that lived in Europe as president of African countries. So they have not performed. They have not led. And unfortunately, because they are so disconnected with the civil society organization and the think tank community and academic community, they don't even hear some of what we say to them. And some of our researches, they don't even read it. And even when they read it, they think we don't know what we are doing. So I'm particularly sad that African leaders have not taken advantage of the crack in global leadership to also begin to reinforce the voice of Africa to assert their authority at the global stage.
While you were saying that, I was shaking my head, because I was writing that before you mentioned it. We've had Africa-Russia summit, Africa-China. And even when I mentioned ECOWAS to you before we started recording this, ECOWAS is like the biggest European conference on Africa, but it's not happening on African soil. And then you have where academics from Africa had been denied visa, en masse to come to Europe. But why are we talking about Africa? And you know, talking about Africa on African soil. Imagine bringing that to Africa to come and talk on African soil. And so I completely agree with you on the crop of leadership that we have in Africa and how it might be a question of poor leadership. But how do we change this? We've also seen some progression, maybe because some of the key voice that is calling for this UN seat is the youngest president in Africa, Sierra Leone. So if you're looking at, are we seeing, because we can't just lump all of these people. So can you see some pattern, or can you see something that gives a gleam of hope with the Sierra Leone president, with some of this, in terms of what the future could be?
Well, it's not really by activism that the Sierra Leonean president is speaking, because he's speaking as a member of the UN Security Council. You remember that Sierra Leone is in the UN Security Council as one of the elected members, so it is on that platform. I don't really, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but let Sierra Leone leave the Security Council today, then you may never hear them speaking about a reform of the UN Security Council. But I'm also saying, of course, there are some movements even within Africa, because I live in South Africa, I could see the energy driving, because there's this big expectation that what India started, that Brazil inherited as the president of the G20, that will be coming to South Africa next year. You know, that there's this energy that South Africa, have said it repeatedly, that they will use that platform to also push for the reform, of the United, not only UN, but all those global of reform. And you will know that when the president of South Africa was the chair of the AU during COVID, he actually tried, that's Cyril Ramaphosa, to try to locate Africa in the global context and to reinforce this ongoing dependency, if I call it vastly appetite, to say, why are they denying Africans humanity? So if South Africa becomes the president, I think later this year, I think it should be November through next year, they will also push. But one has to recognize that if you have few African leaders that are bold to speak, because it's not all of the leaders, they are not even leaders, maybe we should call them rulers, maybe we should use African rulers. Well, maybe some other people get themselves in power, maybe they will be able to push more for not just reform, but for the centralization of African concern at the global stage.
Yeah, you there are some key things you mentioned, and those things also tie into, you talk about the centralization of African concern. And I think, again, that is one of the things. So two things, this is the question. Number one, the dependency relationship. And how does that, when you're depending on someone, maybe foreign aid, some countries in Africa that their budget for their day-to-day has been, is reliant on external aid. So how do you have then the power or the credibility to be in the UN? And then again, the centralization of African listed stuff. Who is going to, let's say for instance, they're going to give an African seat. How do we reconcile who is going to be in charge of the 44 countries? Is there not going to be a competition among, is the AU going to be able to handle and deal with anything that comes from there? How are we able to centralize and put African needs? What is there even a Central African need to begin with?
I think we can. Let's start from the Izulweni consensus on the reform of the UN Security Council. Africa has a position, and I've not seen any African country speaking against the consensus. It was facilitated by the African Union, remember, and they agreed that this is the position we are pushing. led by the African Union and their members. You know, African Union is not a member of the United Nations or the UN Security Council, but we have the A3, that's the three African representatives in the Security Council, Sierra Leone, Mozambique, and another country currently. Now, people have spoken about the question you have raised, that, okay, if we were even to say African come on the play, which African country, there's disunity in Africa, Africa is not united, there's no African voice, there's nothing like seeking African solution to Africa. The institute partner with the Nordic African Institute, and we're working on it on the UN Security Council. Particularly, we are looking at the relationship between the P5, the E3, and how the E10, those are the elected 10 representative at the council, and how the African representative can also collaborate in ones themselves. And there's something that came out. I kept saying, we don't need one single voice as 54 countries to demand for expansion of the permanent membership of the Security Council. Despite our dependency status, despite the fact that some of our countries still depend on external funding or whatever, it doesn't make you inhuman. It doesn't remove the humanity in African across board. And people have spoken about how weak African country is, that where, you know, the big powers, the multinational corporation, you know, the argument that in the international system, the states are not even the main actor, talk less of Africa. To do what we call, you remember at that time, when they shut the state borders, despite the fact that many of the multinational corporations were putting pressure on the state not to do that. Even the big powers are still trying to say relax. But for instance, South Africa, they many things, many, you know, policies, there are many strategies that independent country can initiate for you. It would not be like that. We are not saying African countries will now rise and they are now equal with the United States. But what we are talking about is for countries in the global not to take African countries seriously. Despite your dependency, they can still take you seriously. And Africa should not be as dependent as they are if we have leaders. These countries should be coming to Africa, not Africa going to them. Africa has everything that it needs to survive as a nation and to survive as a people. We have the human capacity. We have the natural resources. We even have this very friendly nation. You know, everywhere agricultural will boom in Africa. You don't need, there are places you don't need fertilizer. You know, there are very, right, of course, there's climate change, but relatively we can predict rainfall and people can farm without even using some of the. So it is our fault that we are still dependent. It's not something that should be a permanent situation. China is no longer dependent. Brazil is no longer dependent. South Korea is no longer dependent. The Taiwan, the Asian tiger. Of course, we know we are not in the same situation, but Africa can leverage themselves and just be self-sufficient based on what they have.
I like the statement where you say it is our fault that we are still dependent. So it does, it, you know, that kind of aligns with some of the things I have said about it still goes back to leadership. And you mentioned something earlier on, you talked about the disconnection between African leaders and the civil society and then the academics. So and one of the things people don't know that motivated this me establishing this center and all of this stuff for the game is actually I've seen like there's a divide. African leadership or African governments don't rely so much on policy, like what we see in rest of the places where institutes like yours would do reports and then the government is in line with those reports. They're looking at the point, they're acting in accordance with those things. African governments just aborted that policies are not research driven. So if we, how do we change this? Looking again at the consciousness of the people, the consciousness, we see the demography, like you mentioned, is changing, but there's still a long way. How do we change the demography whereby we can pursue? So if I look if I look at Nigeria, for instance, I see what's going on in Nigeria, where the leadership benefits from the division, you know, among the people divided along different kind of like identities. But again, how do we move from there and have a civil society that is going to make the leadership act right? Because again, we can't put everything at the feet of the leadership. The civil society has to be able also to be able to pressure the government to act right. How do we begin to change those dynamics?
This is tricky. And if you know, there was the waves of civil society activism across Africa in the 80s, particularly after the introduction of structural adjustment program, which consciously or unconsciously actually re-energized the civil society as they began to resist some of those policies. And those were periods where we also have military governments in some of the countries, particularly Nigeria, that you mentioned. But one thing I realized was that at that time, the civil society was strengthened against the military. And immediately they were able to, one way or the other, depose the military. They just retracted, not conscious, as if they didn't prepare for anything else. So many of these strong civil society began to dissolve. But as we are now, of course, we have seen recently a pickup, you know, resurgence of the civil society. But one thing that you will also know is that African government do not even see the need to strengthen the civil society because they see them as opposition. That's contrary to what you will see in the global north or in advanced democracy in other climate, because they understand the contribution of the civil society to governance. But that's not the way African leadership will see civil society. They see them as the enemy, so they stack them of fund. So where will civil society get funding from? The turn to Europe, and what maybe Europe, America, or even China, and even Russia, even Saudi Arabia. And you also understand the politics driving all of this donorship. That look, you will have to promote the agenda. It's difficult for civil society in Africa working on African issues, trying to decolonize some of the issues to get funding. We still have maybe a few donor organizations that will still grab funding, but it's difficult. But I am particularly happy today to the commitment of the youth. You will see that in the last few years, the youth are beginning to come into this governance space, and they are trying to let the leaders know that we can force changes. You know, they did that in Senegal. You remember, we are not even talking of the Arab Spring. Even after Arab Spring, in Senegal, they did that. In South Africa, 2015, we had the social movement we called Famous Fall movement that cut across Africa and even grounded governance. In Senegal, we had the same thing under President Sall when he didn't want to leave power, and relatively they forced him out of power. We had it in Kenya, and it has not even ended in Kenya. You know, we have in Nigeria, we had the SARS, you know, remember we had the SARS protests against police brutality and in code against bad governance. And in the last few weeks, we had protests in Nigeria. So we will continue to see this. And as we are seeing this, some of those youth are trying to get a space within the structure of the civil society. And one way or the other, they will begin to force their voices to be heard. And well, maybe one will also credit the African Union for strengthening ECOSOC. We have the ECOSOC in Lusaka that are also trying to galvanize civil society across Africa to be able, you know, to make their own input into governance. Because governance, you are not governing cows, you are governing human beings. And these are the human beings. And their voices are exceedingly important. South Africa would have left. Nobody expected that the African National Congress, the ANC, will almost lose out of power. You know, those are, so you are now beginning to see a relative shift and consciousness in Africa, the youth, and also the middle class to say, no, we can reject this. And one way or the other, we'll have a way to force our voices to be heard. So I see projection of this in the next few years.
I agree with you 100%. And that's some of the conclusions that was coming, that I came to in my recent book, when I was talking about democracy in Nigeria and the militarized democracy. I said particularly the youth, and then the women. You didn't mention women. I think women as well are going to play a big role in Africa and change the change that is coming in Africa. But Africa as well, some of the things we don't understand also is that in Africa, we've seen that African Union, you mentioned the AU, we've seen, like, again, we talk about the Africa's role in the global architecture of peace. And Africa, one of the things that, like, Guterres was talking about, the argument they were making, the case for Africa having a permanent seat, was also due to Africa's role in, placed about 40% in terms of peace, contribution to peace across Africa. You have African missions in Somalia, you have in different other places. But yet there's still a prevalence of conflict in some of those places. Where is that dilemma? How do we reconcile all of that? What is causing? Why is there a prevalence of conflict?
Well, because most of the time, yes, we can point our fingers to the United Nations and particularly the UN Security Council. But when you point one finger, about three or four are also pointing at you. So sometimes we have to look within. Despite the fact that we expect the UN to intervene in several instances, but we have regional organizations in West Africa. We have the ECOWAS, and you remember how strong ECOMOC, which is the Economic Monetary Group, was, you know, in Liberia, in Sierra Leone, in Cote d'Ivoire. We have STADEC, you know, in Southern Africa. So we have those tribes that ought to support, you know, both African Union Peace and Security Initiative and also the UN. And I also understand the point you are making. We now begin to see some hybrid peacekeeping missions, you know, we have in Sudan, where both the United Nations and, you know, African cooperate. But one thing we have to note about the African Union, sometimes I criticize them, sometimes we expose what we think that they are not doing right, but we've got to understand the nature and the structure of the African Union itself. And sometimes we unilaterally compare it to compared to the European Union. You know, there's a difference between a supranational organization and intergovernmental organization. Mm-hmm. The African Union is not a supranational organization with binding authority. It just operates like the United Nations, even less like the United Nations, because the UN Security Council can enforce, you know, to some extent, and they have many mechanisms, you know, which they can. But for the African Union, is just solidarity, because it's an intergovernmental organization. Even when they make when they pass resolutions, any state can disregard it. We saw it in West Africa when ECOWAS asked the military government of Niger to hand over, and they even threatened them, unfortunately, with force to invade the country, just dismiss it. And what happened? Nothing. So they later went back to just, you know, normal sending peace missions and diplomatic conversation and all of that. So we've got to be mindful of that. But one thing that we will also know, I think the African Union can still do better, even despite the constraint that they have. But it also depends also on the willingness of the political elite. And that's one thing we kept saying about the African Union, that I think they should bring more, you know, technocrats into the space. The highest governing body of the African Unions are these presidents that we are condemning most of the time. Instead, the general assembly, when they meet, they make resolutions. Sometimes it's very difficult to also, you know, come in somewhere, because there's this comradeship among those presidents. They have a way of sharing coffee, you know, around them. They don't really easily condemn, you know, other countries. So we have to give it to the Africa. What mechanism do they have? Maybe suspension. And so what? ECOWAS, you suspended Mali, so what? You know, you suspended maybe Niger, so what? Those countries. So at the base of it is that there are something dramatically wrong with the political economy of Africa. Because conflict do not just erupt. And conflict in Africa, most of the time, is conflict of the belly. When people don't have the means of survival, they resort into violence. I was reading just shortly, something on one of the countries in arms, and they say about 125 schools have shut down in the space of about 2 years because of conflict. So where are the puppies? Where are those young boys? They will be mobilized, you know, to join any of the conflicting, you know, parties. So those are the problem. If people cannot feed then they are vulnerable to conflict. So instead of trying to combat conflict, no, what you first deal with is governance. And we have seen it in the Sahel, across the Sahel, because people are angry because they are hungry. And that's why they could come up, not directly, but they could welcome military governments. And, you know, not that they love the military, but they just feel that the civilian administration have performed woefully. So at the base of this is just poor leadership. That's nothing else. Mm.
I agree with you. I think one of the things, like in my work as well, that is coming out is Africa has just not enjoyed the dividend of democracy, or whatever I see through our sins. You know, Africa has gained independence, and unfortunately, it doesn't look like the military, because that's been tried as well in the past. It doesn't look like the military is the solution for anything apart from, you know, the status quo. But if I ask you lastly, it's going to be a very broad question. Like you rightly mentioned, it does seem that the AU itself needs reforming. The AU, because the AU was the Organization of African Union, and now from what you said now, it does seem it doesn't have much power, because we've seen whereby in the AU laws where if a country goes to coup and then they condemn and all of that, but now we're seeing that, you know, like Riley said, you know, it's just suspension, so what, nothing happened, it doesn't have any serious consequence. So do you not think the AU itself needs some reorganization, some strengthening in terms of having force? So maybe so, because, you know, what happened with ECOWAS and the Sahel was somehow kind of embarrassing, you know, with the red lines and the stuff, and then all of that. So what do we need? Do we need a reform? Does the AU needs to be reformed first? Does Africa need? I guess the question is, before you go out, do you, because you made a case that even though African governments some are weak, that doesn't take away the push for being in the UN Security Council. But then again, someone can say, if your house is shaky, how can you go out and talk about that? So how do we, so I guess the question, how does Africa position itself in a way where it is strong on that scene? So you don't want to go there and be seen as just, you know, this out of pity, let's include you, just, you know, like you'd be a force to be reckoned with, you'd be respected as member of that council with veto power and all that. So again, it comes to how do we recognize the power we have in terms of, like, the leadership we're talking about, going to China, going to this, how do we recognize that? What do we need to do to how do we bring all of that into form? So I want to take a broad and complete with that broad.
I think when we look at the, let's start with the external projection of, you know, it's making a case for reform of the UN Security Council. When they gathered and they decided in 2005 to have this African common position on the reform of the UN Security Council, well, UN and the Security Council particularly, and this, I think they call it a Zulweni consensus, and they agreed that we need two permanent seats in the Security Council, not just permanent seats with the privileges, you know. Yeah. We want two African countries to become permanent members, and they don't really want to retain veto power if possible, but they also make a case, if they retain veto power in the council, then we want the permanent members who are new to also have the privileges of using these veto powers, and they also want them to be able to stay in a position where we call something pent holders, where they are able to draft solutions and all of that. And when they are seeing two members, and you are thinking, so are there countries in their head? And we also know that countries like Nigeria wants to be a member, South Africa wants to be a member, Egypt wants to be, Senegal wants to be, and Libya, Kenya has also been trying to put themselves in a position where they are permanent member of the Security Council. So, but if you want to look at, you know, one of my editorials last few weeks ago, I made that conclusion. But that you've got to look within. There are people dying in Sudan as we speak, and it's so shameful that Saudi Arabia, you know, Turkey will now be the mediator when there are problems in Africa. You can see the case between Somalia and Ethiopia building up. And Ethiopia, you know, AU is just in Ethiopia, the same seat of the African Union and the Ethiopian government. We saw how long the Tigray-Ethiopia conflict lasted. You know, when we have the same government of Ethiopia and the African Union in the same city, and that, you know, thousands of people died. And today, I've not seen a peace mission from Nigeria to Sudan. I've not seen from South Africa to Sudan. Of course, there, I know there are behind the scenes, there are diplomatic talks, but publicly, I've not seen the president of Nigeria, the president of Kenya, the president of South Africa, leading African leaders to Sudan, leading African leaders to Congo DRC, just our neighbor here. And if these countries that aspire to be, you know, permanent members of the UN Security Council cannot even influence the security of their own regions, then what are they doing? Do they have that capacity to, you know, to go and project externally? So what I'm trying to say, I resonate with what you said. We've got to start within. You know, of course, we want the UN to be reformed. We want expansion of spaces, but that will not solve Africa's problem overnight. Even if they put five African countries as permanent member of the Security Council, would that immediately solve the problem in Congo DRC? Would that solve, you know, the problem in Cameroon? People don't even talk about Cameroon as if there's no conflict in Cameroon. You know, it's just as if they can die, as if they are not human beings. And I will see some African countries going to Ukraine to negotiate peace, going to Russia to negotiate peace, when your neighbors, you know, your house is on fire. So I don't understand sometimes how this will play out, even if they were going to extend the UN Security permanent membership to some of these African countries. But for me, there's no African country that can beat its chest and said, yes, I have done my bit. No, they have not done their bit. Because sometimes we know those people foiling these wars. You know. Sometimes you are thinking of Mozambique, for instance. Even before there were terrorist activities in Mozambique, in Sebagado, you knew as an analyst, you know, there's early warning signal that if you are trying to bastardize a community because of natural resources, and you are moving a community away from their, you know, original location without due compensation, what do you expect? We have seen it in Nigeria, we've seen it in Congo DRC, we've seen it in Angola. So you know that such will happen in Mozambique. And yet, what did African leaders do? What did they do? They just wash over it. And now that is the same way. I think they are looking at Somalia. They are looking at Somaliland. They are looking at Ethiopia. Now Egypt is coming into the picture by trying to, you know, enter a pact with Somalia. And Somaliland is crying foul. And Ethiopia is also warning Egypt. And I'm saying, do you have to wait until there's an escalation? You know, that there's hostility, there's violence, there's escalation of conflict before you initiate peace missions. No, you have to prevent conflict. That's why we have the panel of the wise, you know, by the African Union. That's why we have the early warning system. But those systems are not working, actually, you know, absolutely. So and you have to also think about the African Union. Most of their resources are sourced from outside Africa. Many of the countries don't even pay their commitment to the African Union. The EU is almost entirely funding the African peace and security architecture. We have the ETF, I think it's ETF fund, that comes from the EU. The house where the EU is living is built by China. So when you consider all of this, we still have a long way to go as a continent and as a people.
Well, thank you, Dr. Akiola. This is a very rich conversation. And like Rally said, we have a long way, and we can also see some prospects. But hopefully we're able to. But like Rally said, you mentioned something about hope, pessimistic hope. Or there's something said earlier on. So we can all but do our part, but I want to see a future that is an Africa that is prosperous, and one that is able to take its place in the global stage. Because like Riley said, it has all it takes. It has the resources, it has the human resources, it has everything it takes to be able to participate in that, stage. Anyways, thank you very much for coming. Really appreciate it. I'll keep you posted once this airs, and then, you know, you help us share it among your network. So hopefully to get to those leaders and they're able to listen.
Hopefully. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I need to. Bye. Yeah, bye. Thank you once again for tuning in this week to a very amazing episode on the campaign for a permanent African seat in the United Nations Security Council. Join me as usual to thank our guest, Dr. Adeoye Akinola, for his rich, insightful comments and views on this subject. Want to encourage you to subscribe. For those that are not yet subscribe to the channel for more of this, to get more updates. And please like and share this video. And for now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next time.